Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, possibly 15th episode, something around there, up to chapter 15, so it'll probably be more than 15th, 17th episode. And look, can I say, there is something, on one aspect it's not very extremely strong scientifically in terms of the explanations, but on the other, you get this rare insight into the influence of publishers in history, sort of making decisions which means things that go through all there is that sort of legitimate story, sort of like Manhattan Project was a nice to have thing, but it ran into full swing as soon as the Germans stopped publishing on it. And I don't know whether that's necessarily a great thing. Now, this one, next chapter here, is on the qualities of light. It sounds pretty flaky to me. Chapter 14 it is, and it is by Albert Einstein in 1917. For the rest of my life, I will reflect on what light is. Graham Greene, The Power and the Glory. We say light, but we are thinking only of the sun. Not surprisingly, light suffuses much of my account of the sun. This chapter begins with mankind's attempt to track the speed and examine how light releases colour, then shifts to cultural history, following from where it's brightest, how it affects those on playing field and battlefield through its mutations until it finally gives way to night. Well, I think we're into a real chapter of flake, if I can see, but let's not put down anyone. What is right? Pythagoras' contemporary, the philosopher and poet Epicurus, brilliantly intuited that it was a streaming substance, adding that because it travels so fast, we are not conscious of its motion. But he also held, along with Plato, that there is a fire in the eye if we were to see some kind of lantern. The more traditional belief was that an object emitted particles of light and bombarded the eye of the beholder. The light was transmitted instantaneously. Not until 1638 was the idea advanced that light might have a measurable speed, the year that Galileo, in his polemic dialogue concerning two new scientists, put the notion into the mouth of a credulous Simplicio. He was asked by, I think, Pope Urban or whatever it is, who was an astronomer, to do it. And it was all okay until people got in and said, look, Plato's talking about Simplicio, it means you. And they managed to swing and personalise it. Very interesting, because I can see similar types of things that scientific endeavour has this inherent danger that people can manipulate it. So people not on the main scene, but on the sides, can manipulate how something is interpreted. Quote here, everyday experience shows that the propagation of light is instantaneous, for when we see a piece of artillery fire at great distance, the flash reaches his eye without a lapse of time. The sound reaches us only after a noticeable interval. Galileo was certain that light had a finite velocity, but his experiments were crude. He simply placed two lanterns on a hilltop less than a mile apart, and he never came close to appreciating the tremendous speed involved. The first serious estimate, when a Danish astronomer, Ole Rømer, working for the Paris Observatory, calculated it to be, well, I don't know what miles per second, doesn't make sense to me, overshadowed by the debate between Huygens and Newton over whether light was made of waves of particles. Okay. And I think he was measuring the transit, apparent deviation in clock speeds of Jupiter. I'm not sure. In 1780, because you've got Jupiter is closer and further us by two orbital AU, I mean where we are with respect to it. So we're effectively reach quarter of an hour in additional speed. James Bradley, working on the premise that light travels 10,000 times. G'day, mate. The speed of Earth's orbit. Guys, are you? I have to use the Tarago.
That's okay. I'm picking up
shortly. Okay, mate. Earth speed at orbit. Can remarkably accurate figure of whatever it is, which means sunlight reaches us a little over 7.5 minutes after leaving the sun. I think it's 8 minutes. Oh, what is it? 150 by 10 to the 9. And light spin. So it's. What is it? 3 times 150 minutes is. 150 seconds is 2.5 minutes. Two and a half times 3.3 is 6, 7. Oh, yes, okay, it's about 8 minutes. Okay. Nearly a century later, further experiments by the French rivals Hippolyte Fizeau and Léon Foucault, one employing revolving mirrors, another rotating tooth wheel, yielded a result of something or other. It's in non-SI units, I can't stand it, but I remember coming to a demonstration. Fizeau's rotating wheel had regular small gaps in it, the light passing through from the source to the further side of the wheel was reflected by a mirror, and if the wheel were rotating fast enough, it returned through a different gap. Its speed could be calculated using distance from mirror to wheel, the speed of rotation, and the space in between the gaps. Foucault altered Fizeau's methods to include a rotating mirror rather than a spinning wheel. The light source was shown in the mirror and was reflected a distance second mirror, concave and fixed, then bounced the fixed mirror back to the rotating one. Were the mirror rotating at high speed, the returning light hit a slightly different place, shifting the beam of the original path. The light speed could then be measured, taking into account the speed of the mirror rotation and the shift of the distance between two mirrors. And I saw this demonstration. It's such a lovely demonstration. It was on Einstein. Someone did the speed of light for some reason. In 1859, Gustav Kirchhoff, 1824 to 1887, a physicist of East Prussia, demonstrated that one could derive detailed information about celestial objects by studying the light they emitted, and transforming that discovery would lay the foundation of a new discipline of astrophysics. This was adjourned by a further breakthrough just a few years later. The equations Einstein was to call most profound and fruitful that physics has experienced since the time of Newton. Which is Maxwell. Great Scottish scientist James Clerk Maxwell discovered a particle of photon, which is light, was actually a self-sustaining bundle of constantly oscillating electric magnetic fields. I don't think so, but it means that you can get an electric circuit and calculate the speed of light from it. As the CCNY, City College of New York physicist Michio Kaku observes, Maxwell suddenly realized that everything from the brilliance of sunrise to the blaze of setting sun, the dazzling colors of the rainbow, the firmament of the stars and the heavens could be described by the rays scribbling on a sheet of paper. Maxwell was even able to calculate the speed of light from the parameters of electricity and magnetism. Almost a lifetime later, quantum physics would show that while light moves through space like a wave, it behaves like a particle when it encounters matter. Don't make me vomit. Sorry. This is people who have particle detectors made out of particles, and therefore they say, oh, the wave's turned into a particle. Well, if you detect a wave with a wave, you get a particle. In 1887, Albert Michelson, a Polish Jewish immigrant to the US, redesigned Foucault's experiments and came up with the speed of light of 20 times the Frenchman's accuracy and enough to make Michelson famous. Oh, there you go. In 1880s, the general opinion was that light waves had to be transmitted through luminous light-bearing ether, as it used to be spelled. Oh! Well, it's still spelled that way in the textbooks. Assumed to be invisible and all-pervasive. While working with the chemist Edward Maudslay, Nicholas Maudslay, argued that light required no such medium. What? Thus, a beam from a headlamp of a speeding train will not move faster than a stationary beacon. In this, he overreached. Einstein would prove that speed does vary. In deep space, in hard vacuum, far removed from the solid planetary masses, it will travel more slowly than when near the Earth or similar large masses, though just size matters. Through diamonds, it travels less than half as fast. Look, I think this person is deeply confused. Let me read what he said. Michelson argued that light required no such medium. Look, if you had this in the HSC, you gave this to an HSC student, you'd kill yourself. So Michelson did actually believe it required a medium and to try to get the interferometer to measure it. And then Einstein, that speed, that's correct. Incorrect. Einstein said that all frames of speed of light is the same. It's a postulate. This person's seriously... Oh, this is really disappointing. Until recently, the size of the recorder was just over 38 metres slower than a racing cyclist through sodium. No, this is... He's deeply confused here. That is, the actual light travels forward, but it's held backwards. It's still travelling at the speed of light, but it's picked up and pushed back. In 2000, a team at Harvard thought brought light to a standstill by shining it into Beck, which is a Bose-Einstein condensate. Yeah. No. They're really confused. A medium for cooling atoms down to extremely low temperatures. So light not only travels at different speeds, it can be amazingly halted altogether. This person is deeply, deeply confused. Unfortunately, I have to say that. He's deeply confused. So, if I fire light past an atom, it will oscillate. It will remove some of the light energy, take it into its light energy, oscillate, and readmit it a little bit behind it. Now, the Bose-Einstein... Light is stationary between two mirrors. It's a standing wave. You've got light travelling as fast forward and as backwards. This person's unfortunately deeply, deeply confused. Oh dear. You can imagine this person just, in 1802, 2 years after William Herschel discovered infrared radiation, the physicist William Waltzen found that it shone right through the prism in front of which he placed a thin slit, resulting in a spectrum of parallel dark lines, like cracks between piano keys. Not until 12 years later did Joseph Fraunhofer show that different wavelengths produce different colours, assigning their quality to each colour, so making it possible to match the range of the wavelength to the visible spectrum. Spectrum is Newton's word because he believed in ghosts. I love it. Newton was literally off the fairies. He believed in spirits, and he believed that the colours were the spirits, and that's why he called the spectrum a ghost. The colour resulting from the shortest wavelengths are violet and red from the longest. Anything beyond these we cannot see. Stars. There's a footnote. Our stars, our eyes, each with some 155 million sensors, are good detectors, but not great ones. The retina, or screen at the back of the eye, on which the lens casts the image, contains two different elements, rods, registers of form, cone, so named because they're shaped receptive particles, colour. Animals that are most active during daylight use a mixture of rods and cones, but the retinas of nocturnal creatures are packed almost entirely with rods. Okay, and because we were originally nocturnal creatures, we lost our colour vision and then we re-evolved it. So dinosaurs had colour vision, mammals didn't, and so you've still got dogs and various creatures without colour vision. They don't have it because they were originally nocturnal, because they're only recently that they've come out into daylight and they haven't evolved colour vision yet. This is Rob Cohen's incorrect. Alice, for instance, perceives the world largely in monochrome, but are able to do so in light so dim that other creatures cannot see at all. Most vertebrates have at least two classes of cones. Many birds, turtles, fish, five or four. Humans get the sense of colour from three different types. You know, it's written there. As they are stimulated at different portions, our visual system constructs the colours we see. The important thing is to know that there's three, but it's a combination of three. So we can detect, let's call them one, two or three. We can detect one, two and three, but we can also detect one, two and three minus two, or there's antagonistic stuff. Four of us next set about passing a sunbeam through a prison. Unlike his predecessors, he saw something unexpected. Almost countless numbers of strong or weak vertical lines, which are darker than the rest. This is the sun spectrum. So he saw a full spectrum. Surprised by this discovery, some lines appeared almost perfect black. He knew these to be an optical illusion. Rather, these were gaps in the solar spectrum, registering the absence of certain chemicals in the sun itself. Or not necessarily. It's that they're absorbed. And no two elements share the same lines. He could examine each set of colours, identify the elements that caused it. Yeah, so the black lines is not missing. This man is so bad. This is the worst book I've ever read when it comes out to this point. So the lines are missing. It's just the absorbed. So you can either emit or absorb the lines. So it can either add, or if it's cold, it can take it away. In 1854, an American, David Utler, ratcheted up the argument a notch by suggesting that each element had its own pattern of coloured lines, a unique signature. Science writer Stuart Clark explains the significance of this finding. If astronomers could determine which lines were produced by vapours, they could gain a power beyond belief, the ability to deduce the chemical composition of celestial objects. A few years later, Adler, Sir Kirchhoff, and Robert Bunsen, forever celebrated by the Bunsen burner, not his invention, but named after him. Well, that's bloody hell, that's really interesting. So if all this guff, it's a bit interesting to see. Bunsen was one of history's greatest experimenters. While still a young man, he was working on a sample of poisonous codicil cyanide when it exploded, shattering the protective mask he was wearing, destroying the sight in his right eye and almost destroying him. Undeterred, well, there's a number of one-eyed scientists throughout the place or things. Undeterred, in 1861, he identified sodium, calcium, magnesium, iron, chromium, nickel, barium, copper, zinc in the sun. He claimed that he'd never found time to marry, although a better reason may be that the chemicals his work has made him stink. The wife of one of his colleagues said to him, "First I'd like to wash Bunsen, and then I'd like to kiss him, because he's such a charming man." Well, look at that. Isn't that lovely? Well, you only get that here. So he didn't invent it, but he had a stink from all his chemicals. Oh, God. Okay. They combined a prism telescope into something they called a spectroscope, which one evening, on a whim, they turned on a fire raging in the nearby city of Mannheim and detected the presence of barium and strontium. If they could analyse the makeup of a local conflagration, why not on the surface of the sun? And so, several experiments later, they did. They argued that front office dark lines derived from absorption wavelengths of the sun's atmosphere, and the sun's surface consists of hot radiant liquid, the studying of which would reveal all its parts. They had done what Comte believed impossible, investigated the chemical composition of an object without actually having chipped off a piece for analysis. Okay, I'll just read to the end of this thing because I'll have to go again. At the same time, Kirchhoff and Bunsen were building on Fraunhofer's ideas. Another major figure in the 19th century physics, John Tyndall, discovered a beam path through clear liquid holding small particles in suspension. The shorter blue wavelengths scatter more than longer red ones. In a clear cloudless day, the sky turned blue because the particles in the air scatter blue light more than red. Oh, there's a huge footnote here, but that's Rayleigh scattering, which is all part of my scattering. Okay, well, I'll have to pick this up here. Page 245, and is it still going at 255? Yeah, it is. I've got 10 more pages of this. This, unfortunately, is one of the most disappointing chapters in a certain sense. That's the speed of light not being the same. You'd get shot if you said that. Thanks for listening. This is taking up the mantle again at page 245 in the chapter called The Qualities of Light by Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. Unfortunately, here he drops off by claiming that the speed of light varies in different medium, which it does in a certain way. It's just that the propagation speed varies. The you've got the group velocity and phase velocity of light. So you've actually got two speeds of light. And how they combine to be actual speed of light. So it's like it's gone off. I do like reading that Bunsen Stank blew his eye off. It sort of gives a greater detail to it. Here I think we continue to actually I'm just reading the footnote here. So I've got a footnote to read, and then we get on to some other wacky views from this author. So we've just most recently talked about the sun has the skies are blue because the air scatters blue light more than red light. Here's a footnote. It may be no coincidence our vision is adjusted to see the sky as a pure hue. We have evolved to fit in with our environment, and our ability to separate natural colours clearly many hundreds of allusions to the sky in Rig Veda, Greek epics, and even the Bible, there's not a mention of the colour. In 1968, a study, Elizabeth Woods writes, the physicists have found the blue of the sky, where scattering by particles larger than molecules attracts from the blue colour gives the sky a milky appearance. However, not all the blue is caused by scattering. Light under the sea's surface is blue because the water absorbs longer wavelengths and through the depths to about 20 metres. If you cut yourself below the certain level, your blood will not appear red. I find this just bizarre. But it is interesting that people don't think of discussing the sky as blue. And in Papua New Guinea, civilizations that don't have certain colours like red or orange. Okay, the sun is reckoned to be brighter than 85% of the stars in the Milky Way, most of which are aging red dwarfs. But the brightest sustained light on the planet is not the sun, but the sky beam from Luxor Resort Casino Las Vegas, aimed straight into space. It derives from 39 xenon lamps, each 7,000 watts, every one about the size of a washing machine. The resort's technical manager has explained that every night before the beam is switched on, the strobe lights are flashed for 30 seconds. Quote, we don't want to surprise any pilots. Now, this is bizarre. How has this got to do with the sun? Let's read. Las Vegas and the sun have a usual quality in common, the abundance of neon glow. In 2005, scientists discovered that this element, the fifth most abundant in the cosmos, is some three times more abundant in the sun than previously thought. But Vegas, perhaps unique as a place where neither light nor time is seen to a welcome necessity. The absorption of casino life makes a mock of the futile cycles of the sun and moon, writes Anthony Holden, a poker classic, The Big Deal. Daylight in Vegas is the pushy, intrusive irritant delaying the beauties of the neon clad night, brighter, more beautiful, and far more exciting. There are no clocks on view in any Vegas casino floor. Another deliberate ploy by the management to speed your passage further and further from reality. The only time you keep is Glitter Gulch, is set to your body clock. For reasons no one can satisfactorily explain, poker is essentially an act of darkness, and by which I mean that it feels odd to play poker at daylight. The word poker comes from the German Polschen, meaning to boast or bluff. Neither activity is accredited to clarity or openness. Las Vegas is not so much a city of darkness, however, as one of sinister light. Isn't that beautiful? I don't know why he wrote that. On the other hand, in 1911, Elizabeth Burke was staying with Virginia and Leonard Woolf when, mid-composition, he asked Virginia, "What is the brightest thing you can think of?" "A leaf of, with the light on it," she replied. And that was the phrase that completed his poem. But then Miss Wolfe never visited Vegas. Oh dear God. I don't really want to. Sunlight still has its special power, and throughout history, soldiers in particular have learned how both to use the power and to guard against it. When warfare was still allowed for some mutual consideration, soldiers would put reflecting objects next to the wounded so the enemy would hold their fire. In 1905, during the Battle of Austerlitz, Napoleon ordered his men to leave their commanding position on top of the small hill, ceding the ground to the Austro-Russian army. The next day, French troops were hidden by fog, but the enemy was exposed by the morning sunshine, a perfect target. Arriving at the battlefield of Borodino 7 years later, Napoleon triumphantly alluded to his sold Austerlitz. Now, I think Austerlitz was also a thing of the Gregorian and Julian calendars, meaning that the people didn't arrive at the same time. On occasion, he would instruct his cavalry to put stockings of white fabric over their helmets, otherwise reflected sunlight would enable the enemy artillery to find its range at a substantial distance. The straightness of Roman roads is probably due to their legionaries polishing their shields to provide bearing reflections to keep the roadways straight. Japan's oldest surviving book, the Koji, records legendary first emperor Jimmu, 700 to 600 BC, once chose to fight facing the sun. He was defeated, for it seemed he was trying to attack the star itself. I think they should also do Archimedes. There's obviously things missing here. This is Archimedes and his sun shields. This is solar weapon, but also not Archimedes. Icarus. He doesn't have Icarus. This is a very famous sun legend. I was thinking. If this last instance seems fanciful, reflected light brought real dangers enough, particularly in the days of colourful uniforms which would disappear from the battlefield in field glasses, became pervasive, and range and accuracy and capacity of weapons improved. In the Would-Be Goods, E. Nesbitt and her child narrates chat with an artillery battery about to embark in the South African War. His friendly commander tells them how, with the introduction of the rifle, every kind of visibility is an invitation to die. The guns will be painted mud colour, and the men will wear mud colour too. The term mud colour would become khaki, Hindi for dirty. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? And soon becomes synonymous with war's lack of glamour. The great unorthodox Catholic Charles Pegway to scan the enemy position and was instantly shot through the head. Thank you. For much of the war, French continued to wear their blue coats and scarlet trousers at Machine Gunner's Dream, but the contraindication was a hinge point. By 1914, countries like Britain really made their men had their men khaki, the rest would soon follow. Sunlight can reveal, but it can hide too. In air combat, pilots seek to position them up sun, e.g. the glare behind them before they swoop down the enemy. The same principle applies in sea. On the 1st of November 1914, off the coast of Chile, the Royal Naval Squadron of four ships commanded by Rear Admiral Kraut on eight German ships led by his friend Vice Admiral von Spree, each manoeuvring to get the sun into each other's eyes. A serious advantage in the day before radar, when the naked eye calculations and gun layers and fire controls were crucial. The story in the campaign describes what followed. Krangok attempted to close the fire battle quickly, to find the sun behind him blinded the German gunners, but von Spreed, with speedy ships, get out of the range of the British guns and delayed the battle until sunset. We were silhouetted against the afterglow, as we called the officer of the surviving British ships. With a clear horizon behind us to show up the splashes of the falling shells, while the enemy ships were smudged in low black shapes, scarcely discernible against the background of greater darkness. The German closed in to kill 1,654 officers, men, and lost their eyes, while just three German sailors were wounded in the first British naval defeat since 1812. Well, this is great. Graf Spree. And where does the cat come off of it? And that's really interesting. It's, alright, ship. Sunlight can also dictate fortunes in sporting arena. In NASCAR racing, a strong sun helps cars' tires grip better. But cheaper stands at American football and baseball games are called bleachers because they are whitened in exposure to sun. And baseball and cricket are filled with examples of catches missed under its glare. Not only catches, visiting lords, the cricket-loving G.H. Hardy, a world authority on number theory, saw a batsman unsighted by a reflection from an unknown source. It was eventually tracked down to a large petrel across reposing on the middle of an enormous clergyman. Oh, right. Politely, the umpire asked him to take it off, to the delight of the gleeful anti-clerical Hardy. The fight, William Hazard's famous essay in 1822 describes a bare-knuckled boxing match outlawed since 1750, held 1 December in the countryside west of London. The ring surrounded by covered carts, jigs and carriages. The Ginenders are silkily skinned, panther-like Hickman, the gas man, and the massive knock-kneed Bill Neat. And the two toss for who will begin there with their back to the sun. In Gasman wins, Knee seemed not cowed, but particularly cautious. I saw his teeth clench together and his rows knit across against the sun. However, partway through the bout, the man swapped positions, and soon Hickman, who was the early morning light in his eyes, and the fight ends with an emphatic victory for the heavy, clumsy, long-armed Bill Neat. He's really got everything he can possibly do. The duel in the sun has become a regular narrative trope. Thus, the film Nevada Smith 66, Steve King complains during a shooting match. It's not fair, the sun's in my eyes, and I wasn't expecting it. His opponent, Karma Teacher, who has just tossed a plate in the air for his rookie pupil to shoot at, replies, "Do you expect a man to walk out in the open for you when the sun's at your back?" It's an interesting bit of Graf Spee, isn't it? The great tennis player, Harry Hopman, admitted that he went out of his way to get the help I could from the sun, routinely practicing for up to half an hour before an important match. The purpose of the practice session is to find out where the sun would be when my match begins. The late 19th century Britain soccer was played on half sun Saturday that workers were allowed off. During the winter, the sun's early setting made it difficult to finish games in decent light. Floodlights were used in 1880s, but for technical reasons, they were not widely used in the 1950s. Thus, for decades, British national pastime was played far to the gloaming. The sun is a spoiled sport. Solar interference can also be used to rationalise bad decisions, something I have experienced firsthand. In 1994, the Commonwealth Fencing Championships were held in a large ski chalet perched above a resort 78 miles north of Vancouver. It was an exhilarating venue, with the snow-covered mountains capping the white-clad fences. I was a member of the Northern Irish team, my godfather, and by late afternoon, the Sabre event was down to the last eight competitors. I squared off against my Canadian opponents, I knew that whichever of us won would receive at least a bronze medal. Bout swung first one way, then the other, until we reached 14 all. With one hit to go, my opponent attacked. I parried and riposted. He made no attempt to defend himself, but continued with a second attack. I knew the hit was probably mine. However, I hadn't reckoned on the referee. The international fencing and official nationality is not always scrutinised. And here, ours was Canadian. He said he couldn't award the hit. The sun had made it impossible to see whether I had parried the first attack effectively. As the sun was setting behind him and the shallow lighting was good, this was a difficult decision to accept, and some of my teammates gave a loud vent of their feelings. The fight eventually restarted, and this time my opponent made a successful lunge to win the bout and eventually gold. Oh dear. He had to get this thing in, doesn't he? So it is a fencer. I don't know, he's a thing. Love is sunshine, hate is shadow, writes Longfellow. The power of light is one thing, but its gradual diminution over the latter day is indeed its momentary absence are both part of the sun's story. Shadows at their simplest is where lights can't reach, something called light's negative traces, daytime darkness. Many ancient societies held some in shadows to be their souls. From their point of view, the shadow, having no substance and not is a non-thing, is essentially void. The East African Wanka, Wanika people, are even afraid of their shadows, perhaps believing that these inseparable emanations can watch all their actions and bear witness against them. Zulus say the corpse throws no shadow. Peter Pan snaps off when he leaps out of Darnley's windows, who put a drawer and later sewn back to be put in a drawer later, and sewn back by Wendy. Barry perhaps subconsciously responding to the idea of a shadow being an externalization of oneself. And Wendy, her sibling, are being asked to leave their real selves behind. Who is it that can tell me who I am? Pleads King Lear. To his loyal Kent replies, Lear's shadow. Oh dear, I don't understand what that means. The other end of the cultural scales comes the ritual of Simolki, or Soldier Mountain, a 5,000-foot extinct volcano near California-Oregon border. As the sun retreats in late afternoon, I don't know, this is a bit of a eclectic, wanky. Simolki's shadow will stretch until it falls on the far side of the valley, some 12 miles away, about an hour and a half later. Simolki is a holy place to the nearby Ajumwaki people, its shadow venerated as the spirit of the great power. According to legend, two of the tribe's outstanding mythical forebearers agreed to race against the shadow of large trees or mountains as it swept across the valley. From the tradition came the earthly context. Anyone who outraces Simolki, a possible outcome, though rare, is believed to receive supernatural graces. Since the shadow itself is a spirit being with consummate powers, its unique opponent, it must be treated with proper respect. Thus, should the runner glance over his shoulder mid-race, he will be instantly struck down. Our Jerry Braves make sure they never look back. Mountaineers are used to seeing a phenomenon known as the Brocken, a ghostly shadow that makes it look as if the climber's shadow has become a holy figure with a halo. In fact, the result of the shadow and diffraction effect, a shadow plus an image. I sort of seen something like this. Whereas the dictionary lists 23 meanings of shadow, including a parasite, a spy, a detective, a stand-in, a devil, while to cast a shadow is to threaten happiness, friendship, and fame. In the Middle East, those who bring bad luck cast a yellow shadow. In The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien creates a forbidding land of Moto, where the shadow lies. The ninja fiction, the cult stories based on 14th century Japanese assassins, these deadly figures can morph into living shadows. More innocently, Japanese culture arranges flowers into Eden Shade and Yo Sum. Shadows have even played their part in murder trials. In 1920s, a famous advocate of advocate nailed his man by showing a photograph of the defendant coming out of church, where the shadows indicated a different time of day to the time that he claimed. Oh, instantly. The equations of darkness with evil acts is unnatural enough. Yet one category of people specifically work at night to avoid the day. The untouchables of Sydney, of India. To set eyes on such a person, even at a great distance, was deemed to pollute the viewer. And these witches, if they ventured out into daytime, were usually murdered. Oh, God. On the other hand, in many societies, it was the night that servants frolicked, their masters long asleep, slave spirits rose as the sun fell. A book on the subject of night quoted a North Carolina planter judgment that the slave's night was their day. India was and is full of such dark laws. For instance, through the centuries, they have been regarded as a profound offence to stand in the king's shadow, or worse, to let one's fall across oneself from them. Pollution by shadow, getting the sun between a person and a higher class, was a deep outrage. And even a man of much lower birth might go out of his way to avoid having his shadow trodden on. A French politician visiting in 1957 calls villagers spending their daylight hours in trees to avoid his degradation. Wow. Darkness was not always to be shunned. In hot climates, shade was often coveted, even the symbol of majesty. As pertinates were frequently on the move, the twin demands of comfort and symbolism led to the invention of the umbrella, named from the Latin umbra, shade, or shadow, a portable canopy. The 6th century Sanskrit epic Sarunkala likens the ruler thus protected to a sunshade of his subjects, in that the sovereign, like a branching tree, bears his head in the scorching sun, while the broad shade allays the fever to those who seek shelter under him. Wanko. Oh dear, here's a picture with a large footnote for it, of this dugout field. We now use almost horizontal light to discover the site of lost villages. This means low-level oblique photography, a child of necessity born in the First World War. Air photographs taken at an angle has been produced, even more invention like the aeroplane. But after 1918, the skills acquired by Air Observer of the Great Wars were developed for peace sound surveys, and the Second World War only refined photographers' ability to discover what was lying beneath what was obvious on the ground. Once a land surface has been disturbed by human natural agency, the imprint that the disturbances remain indefinitely, and where features exist in relief, they can be effectively photographed from above by taking advantage of shadows. Sometimes the photos not only reveal new features, but suggest an order of succession, the introduction of not one, but several older worlds. Silver attention to shadow sites emphasizes the outstanding features of form and shape better than the ground surveys, and can convey variations in tone of soil and underground surface that reveal the existence of buried structures. The discoveries in the 1920s of Woodhenge in Wiltshire, teaching a counterpart of Stonehenge, is one example. Literally thousands of lost villages and Roman camps have been revealed by this method. So this is just looking for shadows at a distance. What I would have to say is that we now have ground radar and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know what he's going on about. In Hindu mythology, Lord Vishnu visits the underworld carrying an umbrella, while in ancient Egypt and other Arabic lands, umbrellas, often made from palm fronds, were carried over princes of blood as one of their privileges. But soon that amenity was democratized, and in 1871, a health manual for Anglo-Indian states thoroughly said, during the hot season, it's unsafe for any European to walk out in the sun on the plains between 8 o'clock in the morning and 4 in the afternoon without the least protection of an umbrella. Robinson Crusoe constructed one for himself in imitation of those he'd seen in Brazil. They were very useful in great heats there. It kept the sun so effective that I could walk out in the hottest weather. Early versions in both Britain and France were constantly known as Robinsons. Wow. Well, this, I love that. Quote. In Europe, carrying an umbrella was long regarded as effeminate. The first Englishman who, in 1870, regularly spotted one and made of oiled silk is said to have been sickly and dandified Jonas Hanway, founder of the Magdalen Hospital. Women may have carried them at an early date. Boomer and Fritcher allude to the new machine in their 1624 comedy, The Rude Wife. Rule a wife and have a wife. Oh dear. Okay. Now are you glad? Now is your mind at ease? Now have you got a shadow and umbrella to keep the scorching world to pin in from fair credit? Whatever that means. It's interesting. Okay, light modulates continuously over the day, each stage with its own character, dawn, sunrise, noon, twilight, dusk, gloaming, I don't know what gloaming is, sunset. In Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, 1886, Mr. Usson beholds a marvellous number of degrees of hues of twilight. The battle-weary subaltern R.C. Sheriff's Journey's End is... As dawn rises over the wire and trenches of the ravaged Western Front, exclaims, I never knew the sun could rise in so many ways till I came out here, green and pink and red and blue and grey. Extraordinary it is, isn't it? When the sun's rising or setting, shining flat across the ground, every feature of the earth is caught up and displayed. Twilight inspired Hegel famously to write, only when dust starts to fall does the owl of Minerva, the Roman symbol for wisdom, spread its wings and fly. His way of saying philosophy comes to understand historical conditions just as the point of it disappearing. Isn't that beautiful? Just before sunset, there comes a brief time between day and night when great plans are hatched and all things are possible. Nabokov, in his memoirs, makes the point of mentioning the lovely Russian word for dusk, Stomeski. It is twilight, but only then that an Orthodox Jew may study secular matters. Writers have risen to the moment. One summer evening, as William Faulkner struggled for a title of his new novel, his wife remarked on the particular hues of the southern sky. Faulkner was duly inspired by the book title called Light in August. To Rat, at dusk, the wind in the willows, the light seemed to be draining away like flood water. I don't know how this person's got this enormous knowledge. Red dusk, writes Henry James in the Portrait of a Lady, was retorting to a parallel image, would not arrive for many hours. But the flood of summer light had begun to ebb. The air had grown mellow and the shadows were long upon the smooth, dense turf. Others have called twilight the blind man's holiday, Leu Viet, and even Entre le Chien et le Loup, enter the dog and the wolf. The time when light is such that it's impossible to distinguish between dog and wolf. It was said that pirates, who often attacked at night, would wear an eye patch, which they would remove before boarding. Having one eye not geared to daylight was meant to help them as they rush below decks in search of prey and booty. But in fact, eye patches decrease one's field of vision. Not a good thing leaving from a ship. Removing the eye patch would also inflict momentary blindness as the pirates' eyes adapted. Modern ciphers do practice something similar, though. US Army patrols have often stand-down periods while being inserted for night action, so their eyes may adjust. The fullest moonlight is just too weak to awaken our colour dissemination to the human ear, but because Earth is round, most clouds catch the sun's rays long after it's set beneath them, forming such at such a height that they reflect the sun's light just on the horizon and glow even a glossy huge, a phenomenon called noctilucence. The distinctive light cast by the dying sun on the earth, seen in the blue-grey in front of the light that rises to the east after their clear sunset, is often tinged with pink. It is a twilight's edge. Moments later comes the civil twilight, the minutes after sunset until the sun is 6 degrees below the horizon. That's amazing. 6 degrees, gee. Mm-hmm. 360 degrees in 24 hours. That's the 60th. That's 20 minutes after sunset. 24 minutes, or something like that. Once the horizon was lifted 8 degrees above the sun, true night begins. Okay, so the civil twilight. Astronomical twilight? Oh, let's read this in theme. Sun is 6 degrees below the horizon. Nautical twilight covers between 6 and 12 degrees below. And between 12 and 18 is astronomical twilight. An acknowledgement that it is finally getting dark enough for sky watchers to begin work. Once the horizon has lifted 18 degrees above the sun's true night begins. Reflecting on his travel in Africa, Carl Jung wrote, "When the great night comes, everything takes a note of deep dejection. Every soul is seized by an inexplicable longing for light. It's a maternal mystery, this primordial darkness. That is why the sun's birth in the morning strikes the natives of Africa so willingly meaningful. The moment of which light comes is God. That moment brings redemption, release. The longing for light is the longing for consciousness." Gordon Carl Jung. I think he did do some interesting things around page 256, and we'll just go through here. I must admit, this is the boondocks of this book, where his dots are so good. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.